2018, we will open our public, actually our informational meeting on public safety, and we're opening up the informational meeting on all the agenda items, and we will begin with Oregon Military Department. Mr. Stuckey, if you'll come on up, as Ms. Nebrika, if you will give us an overview.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. Committee members, the co-chairs of the Public Safety Subcommittee had asked for an update on the Youth Challenge Program capital project. $5 million was approved in bond proceeds to expand the facility at Youth Challenge in Bend. And so Mr. Stuckey will give us an update on how that project is going.
Well, good afternoon, Co-Chair Stark, members of the committee. I'm Dave Stuckey. I'm the Deputy Director of the Oregon Military Department. And I have just a couple of slides, and I realize that probably less of me and more of Ms. Jasmine Vidal will probably be better off as we talk about the project for the Youth Challenge program. But I just wanted to give you a couple of high-level comments here, and then we'll move forward. Currently, we're in Class 55. We run two classes a year, located in Bend, Oregon. Our next graduation is in June. We run 156 cadets at the beginning of the class. We have three bays, so there's two male bays and one female bay. The intent behind the project from the legislature when they authorized the $4.97 million bond authority was to increase the class size, and principally to increase the class size with the female cadets. And so we understand that intent. We're moving forward with the design process. The bonds were sold in November. We have a design build team of Kirby and Nagel Hut, which is out of Bend. They're a fairly well established medium sized construction company. They will probably employ somewhere in the neighborhood of 35 direct construction jobs and as a course of this bond. Most of their past work is in the school districts. Our Hanaberry and Eddie Architects are out of Portland. We worked with them a couple of times, and they've also worked across the state, principally in schools, and then some community college work also. And so with that, what I'd like to do is turn it over to former cadet Jasmine Vidal, who is out of Class 52, if I could, and she has some testimony that she'd like to offer.
And before you do, just have to point out that Senator Winters has a lot going on today. I know she personally really wanted to hear this testimony and is going to be sad that she missed you. And so at some point, you might have to stop by and say hi to her.
Will do.
All right.
Okay, so good afternoon, Co-Chair Stark and committees of them, members of the committee. So I'm Cadet Vidal, as you said, and I graduated from Class 52, December 16, 2016. So before I even decided on joining OYCP, I was a good student. I am the oldest of two. And once I went on to high school, I was hanging out with the wrong crowd. I started hanging out with the wrong crowd. And things at home were pretty easy. So I had a lot of things going on at home, a lot of arguments and everything. So then school really wasn't my priority at that moment. I thought having fun, going out with friends and everything was much better than being in school and not dealing with the problems that I was going through. So I started falling behind in school, and then I wasn't on time to graduate. And then the assistant principal from South Salem High School was the one that actually mentioned the program to me. And it wasn't, as soon as she mentioned how it was and everything, I was like, that's not for me. Because I was like, I'm not going to be somewhere else that's not home. So I still was going back and forth on doing the right things and then going back to doing bad decisions. And then it started to hit me once I saw that my mom was disappointed in me because she believed in me, and with believing in me, she trusted me. And once I saw the disappointment that I had brought to my mom and my siblings, that's when I started considering on changing my life around. And then when I talked to Ms. Morales, which is the assistant principal from South Salem High School, I told her I wanted to go to an orientation, and then that was the day when we called OYCP and we reserved a seat so we can go over to Bend. And once I went over there, I was like, there's no way I'm going to join that program. I was like, no. Just to my standards, it was like, that's a lot of work. I'm like, it's not me. So then it was out of my list. I was like, I'm not going to join. And then once I started drinking, and then I was doing other, I got myself into doing drugs and stuff like that. This was by, then it was junior year, first semester, where I thought I had everything handled, and I thought I was going to graduate because I thought I had everything under control, which I didn't. And then once the counselor, pretty much everyone from South Salem High School, they told me, they gathered up a meeting without me knowing. And they called me down. My mom was there. My dad was there. And they made me realize at that moment that I was not close on graduating at all. And then we called back to the OYCP, and then I told them that I would do it. So it was pretty much my parents supporting me and the staff at South trying to get me to do better choices. But it was really on my, it was pretty much my choice deciding if I wanted to join or not wanting to join. So as soon as I joined OYCP, the first 2 weeks, which is Red Stage, it was pretty difficult. It was really difficult. It's much more different than it is at home. More discipline. You don't get to do what you want or anything like that. So it was my decision on staying in the program and continuing to be there. And as far as I knew, I had to stay there. And in my mind, I was like, I have to stay here if I want to better myself and if I want to graduate from high school with a high school diploma. So being there in the program, it actually changed me a lot. It changed my mentality about life. It changed my perspectives. And it's just, OICP is a really good program. Till this day, I wish I could go back again, because it's, you feel like everything's more under control there. You have everything under control. Once you step out of that program, you go back into reality, and it's much more harder. You have to deal with people who aren't mature. They don't really care about their education or about their parents or anything like that. So OICP really helps a lot of people. It helps the students get back into having self-discipline, thinking about what they really want in life, and making better choices within themselves and within other people. So, as I said, I graduated from the program on December 16, 2016. At that moment, we had 36 girls, and I'm pretty sure till this day it's 36. So more than less than half of what the male platoons is. So with the expansion of OYCP, having more girls in that program would actually help out so much more in the in a way that if we have more girls, it's going to help out, bring in more girls and have watch more girls graduate from the program and graduate on time from school and be able to just change their lives around instead of only having 36 girls and then more than 120 males in OYCP. So
what are you currently doing?
So as of right now, I'm actually a full-time student in college, and then at Temecula. And then I'm also a full-time worker, an employee for Sunny Oaks, taking care of seniors. So I work graveyard.
And what are you studying?
What am I studying?
Mm-hmm.
I'm still debating if I want to go into special education, because I've been doing it for about 7 years since I was in middle school, and that's really the passion that I have. But then other things kind of interested me, so I'm right now debating if that's what I want to do or not. So.
Great. Are there other questions?
I just say thank you very much for coming down and talking to us. I've been up and seen the program. It's a great program. But you're just another really, truly great example of how that can redirect people that aren't really bad people at all, but, you know, everybody gets off the path a little bit. And I can remember in my high school days I was off the path, but I ended up going in the Marine Corps, which straightened me out the same kind of way. I didn't get to do what I wanted there very much either. I had to listen to people. And, but anyway, it's great, and I'm glad to hear your success the way you're going now, and I hope you do. I'm sure you will continue making the good decisions that you learned about that. So thank you very much for coming and testifying. It's great.
Thank you.
Likewise.
Thank you very much.
I had the privilege of talking to her for a few minutes beforehand, and just want to reiterate how important it is for us to hear the stories of the real people who've been affected. Mr. Stuckey's lovely, and we like hearing from him, but he shows us like pictures and numbers, and you're a real person. I like real people. So I appreciate your willingness to come do this. I know it's a little bit disconcerting, but it's admirable and really important.
Yep. Thank you.
And on that flattering note, Mr. Stuckey, do you have anything else to add?
Nope.
All right. Thank you. Thank you very much for your testimony. I appreciate it. So, and we'll move forward to Department of Corrections, an update on the geriatric prison population. Ms. Naburka, is there anything overview that you want to give at all?
Thank you, Mr. Chair and committee members. Again, this is a topic that you had asked for an update about, and so we've invited Heidi Stewart from the Department of Corrections to provide that update for you today.
Right. Take it away.
Hello. Let me just pull up the presentation here if I can find it. The most non-techie person trying to do this. So unfortunately, I'm following up a great presentation with numbers and slides. But it won't last too long. Should be that one. Lovely, thank you so much. So good afternoon, co-chairs. Well, Winters is not here. Co-Chair Stark, members of the committee. Hello. I'm Heidi Stewart, Assistant Director with the Oregon Department of Corrections. I am in charge of a division, the Offender Management and Rehabilitation Division. And today I'm here to talk about our geriatric population. So in the community, generally geriatrics is considered 65 years or older. As you know, in prison, incarcerated people show accelerated signs of aging. Because of this, when I'm talking about our geriatric population in general, I'm referring to people 50 years of age and older. So, prison systems nationwide are seeing a growing population of those over 55 years of age. As you can see in the chart, the Oregon Department of Corrections geriatric admissions have increased over 222% since the early 90s.
One moment, Senator Steiner Hayward.
Sorry to interrupt. I just want to make sure we're using the same term.
Yes.
Geriatric admissions means admissions into the prison hospital system or admissions into the prison community or... What does admissions mean in this context?
Representative Stark, Senator Steiner Hayward, it means admissions into the Department of Corrections.
So these are people who are adjudicated and they're already over 50 and they are
in our system.
They're in your system and for the first time or they had been out and now they're coming
and
back.
And they could be coming back. Correct.
Okay.
Yeah.
Thank you. I just wanted to clarify what admissions
thank you.
Means. Thank you.
So the elderly represent the fastest growing population segment of federal and state prisons. The aging population has created new challenges for states in areas of housing, medical care, programming, and reentry planning. DOC's aging population requires more medical resources over the term of their incarceration. Here you can see the geriatric population is almost 20% of the national, state, and federal prison population. And then on this slide, you can see that in Oregon, there are 3,306 geriatric people in the department's custody, which represents 21% of the department's total population. And then of the 3,306 individuals, we have 198 women and 3,108 men. As of February, we had 1,842 individuals who were 50 years or older at the time of their sentencing. 31 of these individuals were 75 years of age or older.
Is there a specific or like a class of crime that is primarily with that population?
I'll get to that in just a minute. I may not answer it completely, so I may have to get you some more data, but we'll see if what I have answers your question. So 4,340 individuals are projected to be 50 years or older at their time of release. Of these, 650 are projected to be 75 years or older. And breaking this further down, 140 are projected to be 95 years or older at their time of release.
I just would ask you there, how many 90-year-olds have you ever had survive that long in prison? People grow that old in prison.
Right now, co-chair and Representative Barker, our oldest male individual is 88 years old. So I don't know of too many 95-year-olds who have made it and have released.
Thank you.
Yeah.
Sorry, I didn't ask.
No, that's okay. So 103 people of our geriatric population are serving life sentences. 18 are serving death sentences. 7.7 years is the average length of stay for those 57 to 74 years of age, and 8.6 years is for 75 or older, their average length of stay. So Oregon DOC's population currently includes 127 men and women who are 75 years of age or older. That's 0.8% of our overall prison population. The majority of this age group suffer from multiple medical conditions, a lot of diabetes, chronic kidney disease, cardiovascular disease, and so on. In a snapshot taken in January of this year, the department had three men who were 88 years of age. The oldest of our male population, and these men were housed in general population at the Two Rivers Correctional Institution and the Snake River Correctional Institution. The oldest female that we had at that time, who's still with us, is 78 years old and housed in general population at the Coffee Creek Correctional Facility. Of the 127 individuals who are 75 years of age or older, 89 of them are ambulatory. This means that 38 are not ambulatory, so they cannot get from one place to another without assistance. Most of these individuals are in our general population housing units, and they are assigned an assisted daily living worker. So it's an individual that's assigned to be with them throughout the day. They will get them from one place to another. They will help them with their meals and any other help that they need throughout the day. That's their responsibility and their job. Okay, so I think this gets a little bit to your question, Co-Chair Stark. 75% of those 75 years and older are serving a sentence for a sexual offense. Many are serving sentences for multiple crimes, but this chart represents the most serious offenses. So you can see that 45% are with us for sex abuse and 22% for sodomy. We have 14 facilities, and only six of our facilities have a medical infirmary totaling 69 beds designated for infirmary and hospice care. One of our biggest challenges is our limited number of infirmary beds. The majority of our infirmary beds are located east of the Cascades, which presents challenges. It's no surprise that we have greater access to specialty providers and hospital care in the Salem-Portland metro area. And this is a breakdown of the location of our infirmaries. There we go. As you can see, all the male infirmary beds on the west side of the state are located at the Oregon State Penitentiary. This is a multi-level institution, so it has stairs, and that is very limiting on the men that we can place in that institution who have medical needs. The Eastern Oregon Correctional Institution is also a multi-level multi-level facility and has housing restrictions due to stairs. And while the Snake River Correctional Institution does not have stairs, it is about a quarter of a mile from one end of the institution to the other end of the institution. And for this reason, we do have a wheelchair taxi service provided for patients who do need assistance to get from one side to the other. The Two Rivers Correctional Institution is a single-level facility, and it has wheelchair access to all services. I think it's also important to mention that while OSCI does not have an infirmary, it does have a health care unit, which generally houses individuals who have special medical needs, and this unit is a single-level dorm facility with 61 beds. Okay. So the data on this slide is from 2015 and 16. We haven't closed our books for 2017 yet, so I didn't want to provide you with some numbers that may change, and then we'll later wonder why they didn't match up. So I can get you updated numbers soon if you're interested in those, but this should give us a pretty good idea of what our costs are for outpatient care. So we paid $17 million for outpatient claims in 2015-16, which includes emergency room, ambulance, and observations for 6,607 individuals of all ages. Those over 50 and over represent 29.4% of the claimants and 49.5% of the total claims paid. Those over 75 years of age, they were 1.5% of the total claimants and 3.4% of the total claims paid. It's important to point out that these numbers are outpatient costs and do not include inpatient hospitalization, because most inpatient hospitalization costs are funded by Medicaid, and the Oregon Health Authority has most of that data.
So, Mr. Chair.
Go ahead.
We don't have a way to really track then. I mean, it's a little bit different, but one of the issues that we're trying to one of the ways we're trying to control costs in our Medicaid population is avoiding hospitalizations for what we call ambulatory sensitive conditions, right? Preventable admissions, for example, for congestive heart failure. Do we have data, Ms. Stewart, about how many, like what our hospitalizations per 100,000 are for these kinds of ambulatory sensitive conditions, the way we track them for Medicaid? I know we aren't paying for them
right.
in the same way, but it's still a cost to the system because
right.
of open card Medicaid.
Co-Chair Stark, Senator Steiner Hayward, let me check with my team. I think we can pull those numbers, but we'll get back to you on that.
Because sometimes spending more money in the outpatient, it's all coming out of the state's pocket.
Exactly.
Right?
Right.
And so I don't really care which pocket it comes out of. It's still coming out of the general fund.
That's right.
So
I'll check with my team and see if we can get those.
Thank you.
Yeah, no problem. Okay. So prescription costs. During the 2015-17 biennium, we had 122 individuals. Of the 127, 75 years of age or older, that were utilizing medications with a biennial cost of $726,114. And this slide breaks those these numbers down into more detail if you're interested in that.
Actually not that bad.
Not as bad as one might think. Yeah.
No.
Based on our current projections, these tables represent what the future might hold in terms of number of geriatric people who we can anticipate inside the Department of Corrections by 2023. And as you can see, the number does continue to increase. So there are numerous challenges inherent in providing health care services to incarcerated men and women ages 50 or older. As the population grows, the demand for caring them will continue to have significant impacts on our health care system and expenditures. The care and attention needed from our medical staff isn't built into our current staffing levels. And finally, institution infrastructure, location of our infirmary beds, and lack of infirmary beds will continue to be a challenge as we get more of our aging population into our system. And so that is a big number dump for you. If you have any additional questions, I'm happy to answer them.
Questions?
I guess the only other one I have is sort of the ongoing we've had some conversations in this committee, and you and I have had some conversations separately about where we house some of our elderly adults in custody. And that's sort of alluded to at some level in this presentation, but not entirely. I mean, if you go back to your last slide, I think, one more back. Sorry, the one with all the numbers. Yeah, that one. If by 2023, which really isn't that long from now, 5 years,
right?
5.5 years, we have almost 7,000 people. We have the 7,000 people, 45 and above, in the system, many of whom are probably, or a significant number of whom are going to be medically frail, right? So,
what do we do?
What do we do with them?
Yeah.
Right. And where do we house them?
Right.
And do they require the same kind of facility that they required when they were 25 and able-bodied. And is there, I mean, given that we're going to have to be covering medical costs for them, is there a way to change the kind of facility where we house them that is less costly because they are lower risk to the other adults in custody, to the corrections officers? I guess those are questions we need to keep thinking about.
Yeah, Co-Chair Stark, Senator Steiner Hayward, Senator Winters and I have engaged in conversations like that as well. There are many other states that are doing different things in that area. Some have a nursing home that they operate through the Department of Corrections. And so I think there are a lot of ideas out there that we can look at to try to tackle this problem.
Thank you.
Yeah, thank you.
We think we need to continue to be creative.
I do too.
And the problem, like with the nursing home, is still there's still prisoners. Therefore, you can't get the Medicaid to pay for it. We would still come out of your budget.
Yeah. So there would have to Co-Chair Stark, Representative Barker. There would certainly have to be some law change, and we'd have to look at it because we'd want to imagine we'd want to access the Medicaid dollars to pay for some of that cost. Other states have done some creative things to be able to access that money, so I think we can look at what other states have done to be able to get that.
We've talked about this for over a number of years here, and one of the, of course, huge issues is so many of those people are sex offenders.
Yes.
They're the dirty old grandpa or whatever, and if we have them not locked up and something happens, the world will come down upon us.
Oh, and I have no desire to not lock them up. Let me be clear about that.
Right.
I didn't mean to imply that you did at all.
But it's a different kind of custodial institution than
a nursing home. I mean,
a nursing home that's not quite as nice as
offers
more restrictions.
Right.
But, I'm just saying that we have to consider new opportunities here, new kinds of facilities as our population changes.
Yeah. Yes. Thank you.
Thank you.
Well, thank you for your presentation. Obviously, we need to get some numbers together for our information from HERC committee, with Medicaid and so forth, OHA, so we can track all that properly.
Yeah.
And, I mean, I don't know anyone up here who's not interested in creative solutions, and sooner is better, obviously, so that we can get a move on before we get further along without being able to deal with the problem. So thank you for your testimony.
Thank you so much.
I did kind of chair's privilege here to go ahead and accept a public testimony from Roger Martin. Given that he's a former member, we figured we'd let him come up and chat for a moment on this topic, primarily about prisons. I'm sure he knows nothing about geriatrics.
Mr. Chair and members of the committee, my name is Roger Martin. I represent the Oregon Catholic Conference. One of our biggest issues is prison reform, and I want to address this particular thing. I just spent an hour and a half at Oregon State Penitentiary from 12:30 to 2 with a geriatric patient, good friend of mine. He's there for murder. He's been there for 28 years. He is less harmful or less dangerous than about 100 people in the halls right now. He's totally reformed. He wasn't a sexual offender, but he's stuck there, and he's stuck there because we have a parole board that should be renamed the No Parole Board, because that's what they do mostly. That's an outspoken comment, and I mean it. My friend is 77 years. He'll be 77 on March 3rd. We've spent over $1 million on medical procedures for him. He had a stroke a year and a half ago. The circumstances, I won't go through it all, except that he was in the infirmary at the Oregon State Penitentiary. The doctor on duty said, we can't possibly treat him here. He's got to go to Salem General Hospital. They called an ambulance. He was put on a gurney, shackled hand and foot. He's having a stroke, but he's shackled hand and foot. And a chase car went with him with two guards with M15s. He laughs about it because he wasn't able to do anything. He ended up at Salem General, where he spent 3 nights, and they had to put him in a special place because he couldn't be with anybody else. He ended up in the penthouse suite. Now, the solution for some is they should be out of there. My friend, $1 million, all out of the general fund, because it's straight out of the general fund, is an example of that. We have a number of people in the penitentiary who should never get out, and we're going to have to treat them medically. At the same time, there are a number of people, and I've met a number of them, who were pre-1994, so they are under the supervision of the parole board. They could be paroled and at least be responsible for their own medical costs outside. I think all of us, you as legislators and me and other people that are concerned about this, need to really work to find some solutions and not just keep paying the bill. Thank you very much.
Any questions? All right. Well, Mr. Martin, thank you very much for your testimony. Appreciate your ongoing passion on the subject. All right, we're going to somewhat switch topics and moving on to the Board of Parole and Post-Prison Supervision. And Mr. Thompson, come on up. Who all's coming up here? And take it away. And Tim, do you have anything, any sort of overview you would like to give before they talk?
Chair Stark, members of the committee, the Board of Parole and Post-Prison Supervision is here due to a budget note in House Bill 5029, which was their budget bill in the 2017 legislature. And we wanted them to come back and provide an update on the status of the Static 99R assessments that they are doing on sex offenders. And so they will discuss some of the challenges that they've had and provide some explanations for you.
Thank you. Okay, Co-Chair Stark, members of the committee. My name is Perry Waddell. I'm the operations and policy analyst for the board. With me at the table is the acting chair, Dr. Sid Thompson. And we have board member Michael Hsu here in the first row. Let me provide a little bit of background first, put some of this in context, since it's all about terms like Static 99 and stuff everybody might not be familiar with. Board's a small agency, staff of 24, $9 million budget. We pretty much doubled the size of our agency in 2015 when we were given the responsibility to assess and classify a notification level based on risk to reoffend in the community, the everyone in the sex offender registry. In 2013, Oregon established the levels. Level one is the lowest level, low risk to reoffend, level two moderate, level three high level. At that time, the board was responsible just for assessing people from out of state and assisting DOC with people that may have been missed when they were admitted to incarceration. In 2015, House Bill 2320 gave responsibility for all sex offenders to the board. So that is when we got a new budget, ramped up, got our staff going, and began the assessments. The assessments are done by two different groups. We have staff members. We call them board assessment specialists. They assess the adult males with a tool, the Static 99. It's used all around the world. It's evidence-based. There's certain questions. They go and they fill it out. They get trained up, and then they do those assessments. We also have some contractors who are licensed. They're therapists and psychologists, people that are members of the Sex Offender Treatment Board. And they do the females and the juveniles and a few certain offenses that are not normalized for the Static 99R. We've really been working hard on getting, because Oregon has such a large number of people on here, we've really been working hard on getting the efficiency and the effectiveness up. In 2016, we were averaging 36 assessments per month. Last year, we were at 127 per month. And so far in January, this January, we did 152. That's with the same staff of seven assessment specialists plus the contractors.
And is that increase because you guys identified roughly half of them that you were able to do basically a review of the previous one?
That's one of the big things that really helped with getting more of them through the system. When we wanted to look at how we can make this work better, we first started with our best asset, which is our people, and we started having weekly meetings where staff could share ways that they found to make things more efficient and make things move along better. And these weekly meetings, and we got a lot of good feedback from them, got us to streamline and narrow it, sort of do a little bit of assembly line, Henry Ford kind of work. We also instituted a new orientation process. So as staff turn over and we get new staff, there was always a training period before we could get any assessments out of them. Well, what we've done now is sort of stagger it. When they first start, we can easily teach them how to do record collection. So they'll start getting records from the different police departments or wherever they need to get them. As they get more trained, they start to do the adoptions of the people that have previous static 99s. We take that information, we put it into a new one, run a new criminal check. And then as they get fully trained, then they can do the full assessment office, or the full assessments. And the big jump in numbers was really due to two things. The first one, like we said, was the adoptions. In Oregon, we've used the STAG 99 since 2004, and we estimated maybe 13,000 of the 30,000 people on the registry have a previous one. And because we can go in then and get the scores from the previous one, we don't have 30 to 60 days of record collections. They can often be done in about 15 minutes. The offender still, of course, gets the 60 days to object and gets their notice and all that, but narrowing down that first one month or two has helped a lot. The other thing that has helped speed things up is in 2017, Senate Bill 767 extended the date when we could complete these to December 1st, 2022. And then it had a bunch of... We had found a bunch of ways that we could really make this work better, and one of them was to eliminate the objection period for level one. There's no remedy if you're going to object. There's nothing we can do. That's as low as it can go. And we found that people objecting to a level one more wanted to relitigate the case than legitimately reject it. So that right there, when we do find someone to be a level one, we send them, this is your level. The 60 days, we don't need to give them the 60-day notice period. We adopted these into new administrative rules. And another thing we did is we looked at the statute. We were originally offering people hearings if they wanted to object to classifications. The statute didn't call for hearings. We got advice from DOJ that said, yes, paper review would be enough. It says we should do a review. So they can send in their materials, and we will review the classification and change it if it's called for, if it's appropriate. And one more thing that we've just recently done, it's new as of last week, is we started getting some interns, mostly criminal justice majors, who want to have some experience in a public safety agency. They are in there helping to collect records and help to assist the assessment specialists. If the assessment specialist can concentrate more on the assessing and less on the record collecting, it really makes it fast for them. And we're hoping that this can really reduce the time of getting the assessments done, because really, if we want to reduce the cost, we reduce the cost by increasing the amount of production per staff member. And now I can go through a few of the things we have planned for the future now to try to do better. Now, as we vet these things, we have a real process for making these changes. We get at our staff meetings, we think of something, we look at the statute, we decide if we can do it. We'll talk to the academic experts, because this is all evidence-based. We want to make sure, see how does this fit in with calculating the risk, et cetera. Then we'll vet it by DOJ, and then we run it by the stakeholders. At the Governor's Reentry Council has a subcommittee on the sex offender notification levels. And then once we've done all that, then we'll proceed with some of the changes. We're continuing to streamline. Like I said, we're up to 152 in January. And I really want to commend the staff and my colleagues, everyone understands our limited resources, so we always operate with the idea that we'll get no more resources, so let's do the best we can with what we have. And something simple as creating a relationship, say one of our assessment specialists has a relationship with the Navy, and so we can get military sex offense records in 2 days versus in 2 months because she's able to call her friend in the Navy. We are also working, the agency as a whole is working on change management. We're using the same system that DAS and many other agencies have successfully used. We have a new mission, a new vision, new core values. And over the course of 2018, we're working to make the board a greater place to work, get everybody more involved, get everybody to have pride in their work, and of course, then increase our production and our efficiency. We're coordinating record collection with our partners, specifically release counselors get many of these records before an inmate is released. And as a reminder, we're obligated to do an assessment of a sex offender within 90 days of their release from incarceration. We also have a proprietary computer system. Our computer system we use for our traditional parole board roles. We've been working over the past couple of years to get a whole sex offender module that's just about ready to roll out. That'll be all electronic records. It'll be a way to share records. It'll be a way to more easily assign cases to people and be another efficiency. I want to talk about some of our challenges. Starting January 1st of next year, we're going to be doing the relief and reclass hearings. It's relief from the obligation to register and the reclassification if somebody wants to go from a level 3 to level 2 or level 2 or level 1. 3 is the highest, then 2, then 1. As we've started to ramp this up, we realized we're actually creating a small court system because victims have rights. They will be involved and testify. There'll be evidence. There'll be actual hearings. Another thing that will cause us to have more work is that each of these people will also get a new assessment. So that'll be more assessments again for our people to work on. Another challenge is Oregon has 30,000 sex offenders on the registry. It's in sheer number, it's seventh in the nation, though our population is 21st in the nation, and we're number one in per capita. Oregon's not a safe haven. It's not easier laws here or anything. I don't know why we have so many. Every time we've had a training, I've asked the academic experts that during the breaks, I don't think it's been studied. People don't know why, but that's a big number for us. And so with current staffing, even with the efficiencies and stuff, we will not meet the deadline of December 1st, 2022. We cannot get everybody assessed by that time. We will, of course, ask for more resources once we consult with DAS and in the governor's office and see what recommendations we can do. But we will probably ask to ramp up, if we could ramp up, get limited duration positions in order to deal with this backlog of people, meet the need, then after the deadline come back down to current or near current levels. That would be probably something we would aim for.
So I'm pleased with the progress you're making at this point, that you've come up with some efficiencies. I am curious, though, if this whole, process and the static 99s all began in 2013, the look at these, why did it take until 2017 when this committee kind of threw a little bit of a shoe at you guys about how long it was taking to come up with those efficiencies? Why did it take 4 years to figure out that system?
Well, in 2013, we were only responsible for the out-of-staters and a few DOC. So there was staff of two at that time.
Okay.
Then when the bill came forth in 2015, the executive director got the funding for the extra positions, and those were filled in December of 15. So, yeah, over the course of 2016, the graph went up as we got better and better. And then 2017 is when we've really been working hard to increase our efficiency and speed.
Are there other questions? No, and I believe at this point, formally, we are to accept the report. Tell me how I'm supposed to say this.
Chair Stark, members of the committee, I just wanted to point out that LFO is recommending that the board return to the September 2018 emergency board and provide a strategic plan, propose key performance measures, and internal metrics to decrease the backlog and provide useful feedback for their staff. One of the issues that we have had, I've been off and on with the board since 2015 and 2014. And one of the big problems we've had is actually figuring out what that number is. And we finally settled on this number of 27,000 plus or minus. But we haven't established any metrics. We don't know how quick we're doing them. And so I would like them to come back and provide us not only a strategic plan, but also the metrics about how we're going to address that. So we have a better feeling for that this work is moving quickly along, and then we can assess whether or not it's appropriate to put more resources to it or if we need to do something else.
So we expect to hear back. You have those instructions. Mm-hmm. And we acknowledge receipt of the report, but I do not believe that that's a voting issue. Senator Steiner Hayward.
Do you need a CFO to say? Okay.
I think so.
Mr. Chair, I move that we acknowledge receipt of the report.
I don't know that we.
I thought you were asking me to make a motion. I apologize, Mr. Chair. I was confused. I'm sorry.
These guys are talking it out. Let's figure it out.
I think we need to gavel in a work session.
So we can't formally acknowledge receipt.
Okay. All right. Well, we'll bring it back and acknowledge receipt.
Okay. So this was not a posted work session. It was an informational session. So in order to formally acknowledge receipt of the report, we'll have to post it for a work session. So we'll bring that back, and they'll let you know whether or not you are to come back for that. So, any other questions? On that note, we are adjourned.
Thank you.